Khooni, The Crimes of India is a thoroughly researched podcast that uses publicly available documents, reports, and books and associated media to provide listeners with a complete picture of the week's case. The following content is often graphic and regularly uncomfortable. Mentions of assault, bodily harm, and death may follow. Khooni, The Crimes of India does not condone any actions mentioned in the episode. Minors are advised to exercise caution before proceeding. Thank you. There's a story in the Ramayana. When Crown Prince Rama was leaving Ayodhya for his 14-year exile in the forests of India, a large group of his subjects followed him. Then he reached the forest near Ayodhya. Once there, Rama stopped, turned around and said, "Men and women of my kingdom, I urge you to return to Ayodhya, to your families. Take care of your own, your elders and your children." 14 years passed, and on his way back, Ram and his family were walking through the forest when they saw a group of people sitting in the same area where Rama had ordered his followers to go home. An elder from that group walked up to Rama and said, "Sire, 14 years ago you asked the men and the women who followed you to go back to Ayodhya, but we neither identify as men or women. So we spend the entire time here awaiting this joyous day of your victorious return." The story goes that Rama was so impressed with the devotion of this group of people, who are now known as the Hijras, that he blessed them and said that they could bless people on various auspicious occasions like childbirth or weddings. There is a story in the Mahabharata. It is said that Urvasi, the most beautiful of the Apsarasas, took a fancy to Arjuna, the Pandava prince. He had come to take weapons from Indra, the one who the Mahabharata says is Arjuna's spiritual father. With Indra's permission and dressed in her finest, Urvasi reached Arjuna's house. But Arjuna rejected her. Urvasi was so enraged that she cursed Arjuna to be a Hijra for a year of his life. But she said that he could choose that year of his life. Arjuna spent a year of his life with a community of Hijras, blessing babies and marriages. Arjuna hid in the women's quarters of the palace of Virata, the king of Matsya, where he taught dance to the princess of that kingdom. Lord Shiva also has a gender-fluid form called Ardhanarishwari, meaning a god who is half woman and half man. Krishna in Mohini's form can be considered a transsexual woman. Kama Sutra, the ancient treatise on eroticism and sexuality, among other things, also refers to gender fluidity. Hindu mythology is full of stories about men who become women and women who become men who create children without women and women who create children without men. In fact, in most Indian languages, there are words that indicate that ancient India was familiar with gender fluidity and non-conformity. Even in medieval India, the imperial court of the Mughal Empire had several Hijras in positions of importance. It is also said that Alauddin Khilji's court treasurer was a Hijra. In fact, in Delhi, even now, there is a monument in Mehrauli Architectural Park called Hijron Ka Kankha, which literally translates to Sufi spiritual retreat or Hijras. All of this logically makes us question what we as Indians know. If all of the above is true, then why has this community, which for so many centuries occupied a seemingly important position in the Indian society, reduced to living like they do not belong in their own country? Why have the legal, socio and economic systems let them down for so long and so badly that as a last resort, some of the members even petitioned to be allowed to euthanize themselves? Why are they fighting to be accepted as a part of the society? The answer to this problem, like most problems that plague our country, is the same: the British rule. Today, I will tell you about a crime that took place in 1852. Today, I will tell you about how, instead of protecting the rights of the victim, the honorable British judges decided to malign the victim and her community. I will tell you how the British Indian government passed an entire legislation to rid India of anything that offends their Victorian morals and their stiff British upper lip. I will also tell you how that one legislation had consequences so far-reaching that it took almost 136 years for India to overturn them. Namaste, Namaskaram. Welcome to today's episode of Khooni, the Crimes of India podcast. I'm Sneha from Hyderabad and I hope you're having a great time. This last week for the podcast and me was pretty amazing. 59 follower growth on Spotify in a year we released only 2 episodes. It's just a testament to your love for us. Also in other news, I had a nice long chat with Pia from Southeast Asian True Crime Podcast. Firstly, Priya is lovely and so is the podcast. If you don't listen to her podcast already, please do. Alex and Pia cover a variety of crimes from all over the Southeast Asia and they have a unique perspective, plus they're both hilarious. Go on, listen to them and tell us how you like their podcast. Felt great to talk to someone who understands juggling life and true crime and podcast and editing and writing and everything else. More power to you, ladies. I have a small note from the last episode, the Tinder crimes one. One of our listeners from Twitter told us that saying Sharma ji ki beti has casteist undertones and can be triggering to Dalits. Thank you so much for bringing that up and educating us. If anyone from our listeners got triggered or felt uncomfortable, we are truly sorry. This is why I love our relationship with all of you. You don't even hesitate to tell us how you feel, and I love that we have this connection. We love that you want us to grow and learn. Just not that one person who keeps personally attacking me on Apple Podcast reviews. I see you, boo. I feel that about myself too sometimes. It's okay, we all do. Thank you though for taking time out to write out that review. It means a lot. And thank you so much for listening to us. And that brings me to today's episode. Some people may find this episode uncomfortable. I get it. We Indians are taught that exploring our sexuality or even talking about it makes us weird, abnormal. And our country was not always like this. This episode will tell you the story of partly why we got to be this way. One of the many, many gifts the British left us with. So, if this episode makes you uncomfortable, sorry, but we will not apologize. Many among us get super uncomfortable around people from the Hijra community. And if you're one of them, consider this episode step one in changing your mindset. This is what I like about y'all. And I'm proud to call Khooni the Thinking Indian's True Crime Fix. Has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? I will admit that I was a little confused about the term Hijra to begin with. I was finding conflicting sources on whether the term is offensive or not. And if anyone can give us more clarity on this, please write to us. The term Hijra in India is often used to describe a diverse group of people who neither identify as male nor is female. And Hijra is originally a word from North India, and there were words in pretty much every other language that mean the same, like Tirunangai, Kinnar, among others. If you're still listening to me and have come this far, give yourself a little pat on the back and sit back, relax, and try and enjoy this episode. Our story begins in 1852, specifically on the morning of the 18th of August. A man was walking to open his shop in the district of Manipuri. It is a part of what we now call the northwestern provinces. This man was thinking about how much tax he would have to pay this quarter to the East India Company and how many meters of cloth he would have to sell to achieve this. As he was walking, he tripped over something and fell. He got up and looked back, and to his horror, it was a hand. He tripped over a hand. A hand that was still attached to a dead body. A body whose head was barely hanging on to the neck. A body whose head was barely hanging on to its neck. The man screamed and attracted a crowd. They all knew whom the dead body belonged to. It was Bura. She was a well-known Hijra guru in that area. The crowd was shocked. Bura was well-liked. Everyone knew her from when she and her family went around to houses in that area, blessing babies and newlyweds. They danced in weddings and other ceremonies and asked for a bidhai or a gift. It was not uncommon to see members of the Hijra community dressed in their finest clothes and performing in public areas. This community was an integral part of the town life. But the town folk noticed that the Goras, or the officials of the East India Company, were often uncomfortable around the Hijras. The locals were not blind to the distaste the British harbored towards the Hijras, who embodied a feminine gender identity and often expressed it through women's clothing or dance. When questioned by the government officials, the Hijras told them that they had either been castrated or were born that way. The Hijras were initiated into discipleship lineages that consisted of gurus who were teachers and chelas who were disciples. They lived together as families and on their keep by blessing people on auspicious occasions. For those of you who are still not getting the picture, imagine this as a colonial Indian version of the New York ballroom culture, like in the series Pose. Gurus were heads of the houses, like the mothers. In fact, in some Hijra communities, the chelas called their gurus mothers. Now, Bura was a well-known guru. She had two disciples, Dulla and Mathi. They lived together in a house for a few years. But in the middle, for 2 years, Bura had fallen in love with a man, Ali Baksh. For most part of these 2 years, Bura lived in this man's house, along with her disciples. All was well. Even though she lived with Ali Baksh, she made sure her family was also well taken care of. A few months before she was murdered, she moved back home. In those few months, she also started seeing someone else. Ali Baksh claimed that she had left him for another man. The townsfolk often caught him complaining about how Bura left him. He seemed angry and frustrated. Some feel that Bura was being abused, so she ran away to live with another man. Some records say that Bura left Ali Baksh on her own. We could not confirm the exact details, but we know one thing for sure. Bura was not living with Ali Baksh when she was murdered. On the 17th of August, Ali Baksh went to the house where Bura was now living with her chelas and demanded that she come home. He was forcing her to do something that she clearly did not want to do. Her neighbors heard screaming from inside the house, and later in the day, they saw Ali Baksh and Bura arguing loudly in the street. That night, Bura's neighbors saw her disciple Dulla run into the street screaming for his life. "He will kill her. He's going to murder her." I cannot understand why no one helped her. Or was she already dead by the time they went in? Then why was her body found outside? Like I said, I found very few sources for this story. It's quite possible that details were omitted when the judges were recording the judgment. In my time as a lawyer and a true crime podcast host, I have read my share of shoddily written or very judgmental judgments. But this colonial judgment takes the cake. During the murder trial, the prosecution presented both Dulla and Ali Baksh as possible suspects. The judges were convinced that they could only possibly be one suspect. They did not examine the evidence. They merely decided that Ali Baksh had to have murdered Bura due to the severance of their infamous connection. Okay, weirdly, they spelled connection with an X. Like C-O-N-N-E-X-I-O-N. Made me wonder for a split second whether it was a colonial white man who wrote this judgment or a Gen Z person did this while sitting in a cafe and sipping an overpriced latte. You guys can decide. The postmortem of Bura's body was performed by a physician named Norman Shevers. He said that Bura was not born like that but had been castrated before she hit puberty, which is why she had a feminine body. Now, based on this one observation, the court extrapolated that Bura was probably kidnapped and forcibly castrated and was then initiated into the Hijra community. First, the Manipuri Sessions Court and then later the Nizamat Adalat the province's highest court ruled that Ali Baksh had killed Bura because she tried to leave him for another man multiple times. In this case, even though a Hijra was the victim of a crime which was under trial, she and others like her were criminalized by the judges. Judges called them cross-dressers, beggars, and unnatural prostitutes. One judge even called the Hijra community an opprobrium upon colonial rule. Does anyone know what it means? 5 points to you if you know what it means. I didn't, I had to look it up. And according to Google, it's an archaic English word which means an occasion or cause of reproach or disgrace. Another judge in that same judgment said that the Hijra community was a reproach to the British government. Oh, this guy was pretty straightforward. I think he didn't like big words. And this case only added fuel to a rapidly rising phenomena that most scholars who studied this period call the Hijra Panic. The British Raj was truly, truly despicable. Bura's death combined with instances of kidnapping of young boys and their subsequent castration put the British government and administration in a panic mode. They wanted to find ways to rid the public places under their governance of the Hijra's obscene and unnatural presence. So the Northwest Provinces in 1865 publicly declared that its aim was to reduce the number of eunuchs and slowly lead to their extinction. They even launched an anti-eunuch campaign that aimed at exterminating the community, like they are some bugs or rodents. And if this is reminding you all of the Jewish genocide, well, I'm not surprised. This is state-sponsored, legally sanctioned genocide. You know, like how the British Empire's resume is filled with so many more such war crimes. Side note. Hello to all our Indian listeners who mourned the loss of Queen Elizabeth this September. How are you guys doing? The Northwestern Provincial Government took this little project of theirs very seriously. In 1871, they passed the Criminal Tribes Act. Now you and I must be wondering, who are these criminal tribes? Like, what does this act say about them? The first part of the law was aimed at groups that were apparently hereditary criminals because of their caste. The second part is what is more relevant in this case. It targeted what the law called eunuchs. The act gave specific frameworks where the Hijras were minutely scrutinized with specific reference to their gender embodiment, domestic arrangements, and living arrangements. They were to be policed regularly. And this law required the police to draw up registers of eunuchs. That's what they called them in the act. They're not my words. Which contained personal details like name, address, and occupation. It's just, yeah, it's horrible. Then it continues. The police had to register eunuchs who were reasonably suspected of sodomy, kidnapping, and castration. So basically, this is a very vaguely worded law that is giving the police widespread surveillance powers. You could even say that the law aimed at making the Hijra community in the Northwest Provinces illegal. That's exactly what the act did. And there were several parts of the act which explicitly prohibit these registered people from wearing female clothes or female jewelry or performing in public, essentially taking their livelihood away from them. And the act even said that children could not live in Hijra households. And there were other several rules which basically interfered with how the community lived and practiced their Guru Chela rituals. And after this, as you all can imagine, the life for this community became literal hell. Their houses were often visited by the police and they were harassed. They were beaten up. If there were crimes committed against them, they were not taken seriously. And in fact, the officials of the British government looked at this community as ungovernable. British texts from back then described this community as invoking images of filth, disease, contagion, and contamination. And they often said that this community was addicted to sex with men and they were a danger to public authority and were a threat to colonial political authority. Essentially, the empire felt threatened by someone who did not look like them, who did not live like them, or did not think like them. just like they did throughout the empire. And it's quite clear, okay, that gender expression or sexual behaviors, domestic arrangements or intimate relationships were central to their governance, because they thought if you can control this, you can control a people. Because otherwise, why would they be threatened by a community that barely harmed anyone and for most part largely kept to themselves and had like a modicum of respect in the society they were a part of? There was also another direct consequence of this draconian legislation. As time passed on, educated Indians, especially men who were educated in the British Indian education system that slowly began to take over the country, began to denounce hijras because they adopted the ideals that were taught to them. So they adopted the value system that was taught to them, which was essentially your Victorian values. And these men began to believe that hijras were kidnappers and castrators of Indian boys, and they were obscene and they were immoral. And as we all know in our society, what a man believes, his entire family believes. From when this legislation was passed till almost the early 20th century, the Northwest provinces annually tracked its progress in slowly eliminating this community. Yeah, they had numbers. And slowly, as more time passed, the Indian middle class, which began to slowly evolve, started to ostracize the hijra community and isolate them. While it was still okay for most Indians to get their blessings at weddings or births of their children, they wanted the hijras to be kept away. There was no attempt to reverse this isolation of the community. That law was the beginning of a dark period for the hijra community in India. In fact, even after the judgment that decriminalized Section 377 of the IPC, the transgender community in India still faces discrimination in areas of employment, living, and everything else. In 2014, the Supreme Court of India held that all persons have the constitutional right to self-identify their gender. And this is when we come to the second story. The second story I'm going to tell you today happened after the 2014 judgment. In fact, this case happened after the passing of the Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Act 2019. I'm going to tell you the story of Dakshayani. Dakshayani lived with her relatives and her brother Selvaraj in Tuttampatti village in Salem district in Tamil Nadu. She was 17. Her brother and her lost their parents, and that's why they were living with their relatives. Dakshayani was in a lot of anguish. As soon as she started expressing her gender, which was different from her birth gender, her family harassed her every day. Her brother was not pleased. He was downright pissed. He made her feel guilty for being who she was. One day, while she was walking home from school, she ran into a few members of the transgender community there. Slowly, unable to bear the abuse at home, Dakshayani befriended a few trans women in Salem. Unknown to her family, she began to make plans to run away and live with these women. She packed her bags and belongings and waited. One night, when her brother was away and her family was sleeping, she ran away. She went to her friends in Chengalpattu. She knew that they would accept her for who she is. While they took care of her for a while, she slowly found out that she could not live with them forever. This is because she was a minor. This is because, according to the Rights of the Transgender Persons Act 2019, trans minors have to stay with their birth family or their blood relatives till they attain the age of majority, that is 18. The Act does not recognize the trans community as family. Now, unfortunately, Dakshayani's newfound family did not have a choice. Her family could face prosecution if she continued to live with them. After almost 15 days after she came to live with them, they took her to a police station and the officials there decided to return her to her birth family. It must be noted here that during that time, none of her birth family even came looking for her. She was away from home for 15 days and they all knew that she was expressing her sexuality. But Dakshayani begged and pleaded both the police and her new family that she did not want to go back to her birth family. She kept saying that she faced a lot of abuse. But unfortunately, their hands were tied. So a few trans women from her community took her to the Tharamangalam police station. The police called her birth family to come and collect Dakshayani to take her home. While she was there, the police and the district child protection unit, Salem, made the family give it in writing that they will take care of her and that they will not harm her in any way. And the family signed it, including her brother. They took her home. She lived with them for a little while. But she felt that she did not belong with them. She wanted to go back to her family. On the 30th of August 2021, Dakshayani told her birth family that she wanted to go back and live with her family. She said that she was not having peace of mind living with them. And this annoyed her brother and they began to have an argument. Selvaraj began to act very violently and beat her up. He kept yelling that she was a disgrace to his family. In a few minutes, the fight got so bad that Selvaraj stabbed Dakshayani with a knife. The family could not believe their eyes. However, they reacted quickly and called in an ambulance. But Dakshayani died on the way to the hospital. Police arrested Selvaraj the next day. He confessed to the murder. In his statement, he said that Dakshayani's gender brought shame upon their family and who could not condone it. So cases like this point out the need to re-examine the 2019 Act, especially with regard to the section that relates to minor transgender persons needing to stay only with their birth family. It is quite well known that throughout our country, minors who come out as trans to their families face abuse from their birth families. This section also faced a lot of protests from NGOs and members of the Indian trans community, but the bill was passed without any changes to this section. This is a sad reality for LGBTQI kids in India. They often face bullying and even sexual harassment in some cases and have no resort to get out of this plight. In fact, a 2018 study by Sahodaran, which is a male sexual health project, along with UNESCO, states that 60% of those identifying outside mainstream sexual identities were physically harassed in middle or high school, and 50% in higher secondary. Sexual harassment was high among the participants from primary schools at 43%. However, only 18% of them reported that bullying to school authorities. Even when they reported, 29% of teens were asked to change their feminine behavior so that they will not be bullied. And 49% were told to ignore and simply carry on. These are disturbing statistics for our country. The mainstream media is not helping manners. There was an incident in 2016 in which I can safely say that the perpetrator was Kannada TV9. A trashy news channel by any standards. Suryana was a trans woman studying cosmetology, beauty and wellness at St. Joseph's College in Bangalore. So she found out that she was a subject of a sting operation run by the news channel. The show was called Operation Anandi, where the news channel lied that Rhea had a sex change operation and she was forced to do it by other members of the trans community who she was living with. Now, Rihanna was not able to go to college after the program was aired. Her landlord was asking her to leave the house. While her parents' faces were partially hidden, Rihanna's photos were projected for all and sundry to see. Rihanna said that she underwent the surgery willingly. She said that she knows her body and her emotions. She said that it's not like she had a choice. She even said that she was happy living with her new family and that her community elders take care of her like she's their family. As everyone from India knows, TV9 does not have the best reputation. They're awfully biased against the LGBTQI communities and I personally remember this one particular program where TV9 journalists in Hyderabad, well, if you can call them that, made fake profiles on a gay dating app and publicized the names of the members of that dating app so that everyone can see them. Despicable. So who do you think fuels the hatred in the brains of, you know, Indian educated masses even now? You do not have to look further than your regular 9 PM news channels. Even in September 2022, you know, like, which is a few months ago, I read like a harrowing incident. A married Indore man named Noor Muhammad, who was in a social media relationship with a transgender woman named Zoya, invited her home when his wife went to her parents' village. So Zoya showed up And that's when he realized that the woman with whom he had been speaking to was a trans woman. And there was a huge argument and he strangled Zoya to death. He then cut her body into two pieces. He stuffed one part into a sack and threw it into some bushes near a bypass close to his house. He hid the other part of her body in a box in his house. I mean, he's currently in police custody and the case is going on. Now, it pains me to think, did Zoya know that the man she had been talking to was married? Did Dakshayani ever think that her brother could possibly hate her so much that he would kill her? Or lastly, who killed Bura? That, dear listeners, is the end of our stories in this episode. India now has a transgender judge, models, actresses, and our CJI seems to be someone who is an LGBTQI ally. But crimes against the LGBTQI people are also rampant. Something needs to happen and one of this needs to counteract the other. Let me know what you think. Did I criticize India too much, like my favorite Apple reviewer said? Let me know. Also, a big, big thank you to my wonderful grandfather who told me the stories from Ramayana, Mahabharata and the Mughal court. It is quite evident from where I got my storytelling genes. I love you, Tata. I know this episode kind of got academic in the middle, but there were things that needed to be said. Take a moment, reflect and think of how you can help make a difference or a change in our country right now. And this is me, and until next time, have a very coony week. And if you have the time, you know what you have to do. Follow us wherever you listen to us so you'll not miss anything we upload. And I love you so much. Bye!